Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. I wonder if our audience has had a chance to check in on H+. We need to clue everybody in that, hey, that's available to everybody now.
That's right. Follow the links at The Speculist or right there on our if you're listening to this show live, the page you're looking at, right, just scroll up a little bit and there's a link to the H+, the digital series YouTube site. You need to go to that page and you can watch the first episode. Subscribe before midnight tonight and you get a sneak preview. You get special access to the first, I believe, episodes 3 through 6. So I think the first 3 are up now and you can watch up to the first 6 if you get on there now. And once you start watching it, you're going to be hooked because it's a really cool series. We were pleased and honored to have the creators of that show with us last week.
That was a fun conversation. I think it was pretty much decided everyone on the call, if that technology was available, we'd pretty much all take it. You were one of the takers, right, Phil? I'm pretty sure
yeah,
you were, right?
Yeah, I'll just sign yep. me up. You bet. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. And you know, it's hilarious because, well, we don't want to give too much away, but, you know, after you watch the show, you'll see why that's funny, why we would still be signing up for it. Even after watching the show. So,
well, okay, I will say that I would sign up for it expecting that what happens in the show would not happen. Okay, let me just put it that way. That would be my take on it. If I really thought that what happens in the show was going to happen, no, I wouldn't sign up. No one in their right mind would, clearly. But, that question is a good litmus test as to how positive an outlook you have on technology. And you and I, obviously, and the creators of that show, we all, deep down, we expect technology to do good things for us and bring us advantages, not to,
my point on technology has pretty much been, Phil, it's always been 2 steps forward, 1 step back.
Yeah.
No, I mean every thing that happens, there's always a downside, but the upside's always better. You know, it seems like with technology, and so yeah, sign me up. I'm on board, but I also want to invest heavily in a firewall. I'll leave it at that.
Well, and you know, my strategy that works out well for me from an economic standpoint as well as from a technology adoption standpoint, is I'm very enthusiastic about new technologies, but I'm not a very rapid adopter at all. And I've been holding out now for I was going to jump from iPhone 3GS to iPhone 5, and, you know, Apple's dragging their feet, they're taking forever, and I'm just feeling like, oh, crying out loud, I'll get a 4S, because that will make them release the 5, you know.
The rumor sites are pretty much saying that it's this fall, and so even though I've got this big crack in the display of my iPhone 4, I'm going to hang on to it until the 5 rolls around. I presume in a couple of months, so maybe I can hang on that long.
Yeah, well, I'm my birthday is not till the end of the month anyway. So anyone thinking about a gift for me, or you know, I think most of you know how to reach me, and so it's a thing to think about. So before we jump into our topic tonight, which is curiosity triumphs. Anything interesting going on in your world? Any updates for us on any subject? I believe we were talking about a little personal bit of technology that you're using this evening.
Oh, yeah.
Commented on earlier. There,
yeah,
I've fed you as much as I can. It's like, objection, Your Honor.
Yeah,
meeting
you
the
set me up pretty good there, Phil.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I needed every bit of that. I was like, where are you going with that? A couple of weeks ago, it's been longer than that. Anyway, I had mentioned on the show that I had purchased a Chromebook. And
right.
I was unimpressed and not ready. I said the words
you
I
said
used
it was
were,
not ready for prime time. It was
exactly
as bleak a gadget review as I have ever heard from Stephen Gordon, I must say.
Yeah.
You really
panned
some
gadgets,
Chromebooks.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I mean it was just limited in so many different ways. The things that I wanted it to do, it just simply would not do. Now and you know, when I purchased it, basically the promise from the Google people. Now keep in mind this thing is, it's like a netbook. Okay, it's like a very small notebook. There's
right.
no optical drive, there, you know, no CD-ROM or anything like that, no DVD. No hard drive either. It's all flash memory. And the operating system, deep down, I think it's some version of Linux. But what it is, it's really like the Chrome browser, but made into an operating system, sort of. At least that's the way it was initially. And but the promise from Google was, hey, you know, buy it. It will get better because rather than you having to purchase updates to the operating system and installing it, we'll do all the updates from here. And you just hang on to the machine. It'll just keep getting better and better. And so, you know, basically, Phil, I took the machine and tossed it in the back of the closet.
Right.
Word got around on the internets that, the Chromebook had been updated. I said, oh, cool. Well, maybe I should plug it in, get charged back up and see what I got there.
Yeah.
The update, and this was an update about a month or so ago, just absolutely was game-changing. Now it does literally everything I want it to do. I'm running the show on it tonight. I had a real problem bringing up PDFs. I use a lot of that in what I do in my day job. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it does everything I needed to do for my day job now. I can, I write letters on it using Google Docs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. You know, you can't, you don't have Microsoft Office. How do you operate? Well, turns out that with Google Docs and being able to export it as a Microsoft Word document or a Microsoft Excel document or whatever it is you're doing, that's 95% of pretty much everything I needed to do for work. And, as long as you're not getting it to be a gaming computer, you'd be highly disappointed if that was your reason for getting it. But if you want something that's instant on, I mean, literally you open it up and it's bang, it's on. There's no warm up time, and does that kind of thing, where it's a browser and does browser based apps. The Chromebook is getting real. It started out pretty much a toy for someone who just liked to it was kind of a hacker's kind of toy at first, but now it's a real tool for real users. And I'm recommending it now. They came around.
Well, it's hard to beat that price point, isn't it?
Yeah.
The question is, are you getting functionality for that money? Are you getting a tool that does something?
Well, put it this way.
Previously you were saying
I,
no, and now you're saying definitely you are.
Yes, and I picked up two of them now. I own two of them. And both of them I was able to pick up used on eBay for under $250. And closed, when the clamshell's closed, it's about maybe just a little bit bigger, not much. The form factor is about the same as an iPad.
Oh, okay.
And it's about the same weight too, and you can carry it around about that same weight. And then you open it up, and it's you got a keyboard, and
right.
it does all these other things. It's much more functionality for a whole lot less of the expense than an iPad. So, if that's your thing, and I recommend it.
Very cool. All right. Well,
yeah.
Stephen, thank you for updating us on your. I'm sure the folks at Google are grateful for your revised and updated review. And you got me curious now. I'm going to have to check out the Chromebook at this point.
Oh, yeah. It's getting better. It's getting better. So.
Well, before we jump into the show, I have one quick thing I want to say. Wasn't able to get into it last week, but the situation has only improved in the past week. Just a quick shout-out to our homegirl, Missy Franklin, four-time Olympic gold medalist from right here in Colorado. We've had so much bad news all summer long in Colorado. It's nice to have this piece of wonderful news. And I want to make a note to everyone. Someone go into Wikipedia and fix this, please. It says she was raised in Aurora, Colorado. That's not true. She goes to high school in Aurora. She's actually from Centennial, lives right up the street from our buddy Michael Darling. You know, we're just super excited and proud of Missy and what she's accomplished and the honor she's brought to our country in the Olympic Games. Have you caught any of the Olympics this time around, Stephen?
I catch it in bits and pieces. I enjoy the swimming especially. The water polo is I've always been fascinated with that, and it's if you've ever spent any time like out in the ocean or something just treading water.
Yeah.
You get tired just keeping your head above water. These guys, are out there the entire time, and they're not just even when they're not still because those guys, they're sitting there, basically treading water fast and hard enough to where they're waist high out of the water, pretty much the entire time they're playing. And then, they got to swim and everything. I'm just impressed with those guys. I don't know. It's just I find that fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I observed the same thing watching track and field. I love the track and field events. It was great seeing Usain Bolt do it again in the men's 100 meter. But some of these less glamorous ones or like more old fashioned ones are just really fascinating. Things like the shot put. I mean, an event when you think about it, you go, that's just insane, right? I mean, they're spinning around and throwing a cannonball, right? Or I was watching the women's hop, skip, and jump last night, or it might have been the night before last. And you just watch them and go, how is this a thing, right, that, people devote their whole life to? I mean, the millions of people are watching on TV right now with bated breath to see who's going to win the women's hop, skip, and jump. There's something almost surreal about it, but it's so cool too at the same time. You watch people doing performing at these kind of pushing the edge of what humans are able to accomplish, and it's very inspiring. I do enjoy the Olympics. There's a lot of political stuff around it and those kinds of things that I don't care for, but watching the athletes themselves compete is just it's always terrific. And thanks to everyone who's listening live who's not watching the Olympics.
It almost doesn't matter what the event is, does it? It's always a joy to watch someone who is really good at something do it at the at the top of their game.
Yeah,
it hardly even matters what that thing is. Even the skeet shooting. I believe she's an American. And she's been in the last four or five Olympics, and she shot 99 out of 100 skeet to win the gold. That's just amazing.
That's amazing.
I mean,
yeah.
If you've ever shot skeet, Phil, that's a level of perfection that is just amazing.
Stephen, I'll tell you that I'm just too much of a humanitarian to do that to a clay pigeon.
you don't like to put down the clay pigeons. Huh?
I am too tender-hearted. That's always been a problem. No, it really is incredible. And the thing you say is true. The people at the top of the game, their game, and they're all at the top, right? And it means it's so important to them, and then it becomes important to like their nation and to the world. It's really it's really great fun to watch. It's a fun couple of weeks. The Olympics, but that actually makes an interesting.
Sally asked a question that's a really good one. Sally asked, "What will the body and brain augment Olympics be like?" And to that, Sally, I have to ask, how do we know we're not already watching it?
Well, certainly the issue of prosthetics came up. There's the South African runner with the with prosthetic legs, who was accused by some of having a an unfair advantage. It's like, well, the unfair advantage didn't even get him to bronze, so how unfair was it? You know, I think those that debate is one we're going to see more and more of every Olympics from here on until we just decide anything goes, I think. Or the Olympics is going to become a very strictly guarded, mostly original human substrate kind of.
I think you're going to see a divergence. I think you'll
yeah.
There'll be one set of games where anything goes that everybody will watch.
Yep.
And then another set of games that are held in high esteem and that nobody watches. And that's the mostly original substrate human game.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, well, I was looking at, okay, unfair advantage. If that's an unfair advantage, those things actually exist as shoes, and let all the runners have them, right? Problem.
You don't
right?
Have the
problem
blade?
Solved.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, and everybody gets to run faster. So what? You know, I mean, shoe technology has improved. Just call them shoes and say, here, everybody have. They won't be all that easy to solve, but actually they are. Because ultimately you can say, if anything's an advantage, let everybody have it, right? And and you take it from there. But the thing I was going to say about the Olympics, and I couldn't find it now. I saw it earlier today. There was someone had put up a pie chart talking about, you know, there's this talk going around the Curiosity probe, which is our topic. We're talking about the new Mars rover, which landed earlier this week, and we're very excited about it. All this talk going on around, you know, why would they spend all that money on this piece of technology. You know, we've been to Mars. There's all this suffering on Earth. There's poor people. There's sick people. There's, you know, people in pain. And all that money could go to that. And it was a great little pie chart. It just showed how much money we spent on Curiosity, right? And then how much money has been spent on the Olympics. And Curiosity is a tiny little sliver, you know. I mean, it's like you look at that and you go, okay, well, there it is. Okay, so why are we, you know, why do we do anything except for, you know, take care of the poor? And maybe we should. Maybe we should do nothing else. Stephen, you and I shouldn't even be talking right now. We should be volunteering in a soup kitchen or something. But, the point is, if it's an argument against one thing, it's an argument against everything.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anyone make that case against the Olympics. Why are we spending all this money on the Olympics when there are these other humanitarian problems to be solved? It's like we recognize that we need to solve those problems and we need to continue to be humanity at the same time. And one of the great defining characteristics of humanity is our curiosity, our desire, I would say even our need to find things out, to look beyond the horizon, you know, to walk up to the top of the hill and see what's over on the other side. This is a big driving force.
Phil, it's the way we do solve problems, you know. I mean, and I'm not just talking about Tang, you know, spin-off and Teflon coatings on our pans.
Yep.
All science is the way we get to the next technology, and and that helps us solve problems like hunger and desalinating water and everything else. You know, that's the way we humans do things, and you can't put limits on science. You can't say, well, you know, we're going to do this science project, but no probes to Mars. I mean, it's got to be wide open. And, you know, our it'll be hobbled. You cannot put limits on curiosity.
That's right, and because one of the things that leads us to improving our circumstances. It's a driver or an enabler of what I call the human imperative. Just this ongoing effort by humanity to, as individuals and as a group, to improve our circumstances. And one of the ways we do that is just by knowing more than we did before. I mean, we talked about this a little bit. It's interesting, and we're going to come back to the Higgs boson in a few minutes, but we talked about this a little bit around the Higgs boson, right? I mean, and you could make that exact same case there, right? Nobody got fed by that research, you know. No injured people were treated because of that research, and ultimately there's no practical application to it. But there's no question that we're better off having a confirmed understanding of how the universe works than we were not knowing that. All these pieces are cumulative. It goes back to the Spock's chessboard analogy that you like to use, you know, Stephen. In fact, to go back to your technology moves us one step forward and two steps back. Was that tonight we were talking about that? The show's
Oh, yeah.
It was, wasn't it? Yes.
They sometimes run together.
Yeah, they run together in my head. It's actually one step forward a couple steps up, right, to another level, you know, and then maybe back or then down or something like that. It's multidimensional, and how all this adds up to the improvement, to the betterment of humanity is sometimes not straightforward. But we know we're better off knowing more about the universe, and moving ourselves out into space is just, you know, a hugely important step.
Well, you know, there's so many things that we don't know. You know, there's some things we know we don't know, but there's some of the most interesting things that that we'll live to see, Phil, are things that we have no idea that we don't know. It was that way, you know, with the, you know, electricity and the electron, you know, back our 19th century understanding eventually led to 20th century electronics. And that came from our, you know, our growing understanding of the universe back in that century. And so who knows what the Higgs boson understanding that we're gaining now will deliver. We don't have any clue.
We don't know.
And that's fine, to not have any clue at this moment.
Great quote from Jab in the chat room. We wouldn't even know about the starving people without technological advances.
That's right.
That is exactly right.
People talk about the good old days. Sometimes, back in the good old days, you know, we didn't have all these serial killers. No, you had serial killers. You just didn't hear about them because you didn't have media telling you that there's some serial killer four states away. You know, if there was a serial killer four states away back in the 50s, you didn't know about it.
Right.
So,
right.
I don't know. Right.
Also, police procedures weren't as advanced, and sometimes they just got away with it their whole life too. But that's that's a sad other story for sure. I don't know. Did you see the XKCD cartoon?
I guess not. What's that about?
I'm sure you're familiar with that comic strip, XKCD. It's like these little stick figures, and it's usually about science and technical stuff. This one was it was just a picture of Curiosity heading down to Mars, and it says, "Your excuse for anything today. Sorry, I was up all night trying to download photos taken by a robot lowered onto Mars by a sky crane."
That's awesome.
I think that sums it up exactly. Anyone who's seen those renderings of what that looked like, that is just, you know, it's just amazing. You know, it's like, here we got this rocket orbiting Mars, this spacecraft orbiting Mars, and now it's lowering this car, right, down to the to be released and then to land on the planet's surface.
We have spent like the last, I don't know, couple of years at least, and really longer than that, feeling kind of bad about ourselves as far as space technology goes.
Mm-hmm.
We've been kind of stuck in low Earth orbit as far as our manned program goes, and then we even lost the shuttle. Of course, that's quickly being replaced by private vendors like SpaceX, and that's probably for the better. I'm certainly excited about that.
Yep.
But here we have NASA doing something awesome. They put a monster truck on Mars. You know, I mean, that's it's just awesome.
Right.
I mean, we did something big, just like in the good old days. You know, I mean, it's very cool, and who knows what we're gonna find, and I can't wait.
Well, I'll tell you what they're looking for. One thing, we should note that the actual name of the probe is the Mars Science Laboratory, and I guess Curiosity is the name just of the rover, just to be very precise. But the mission overall, I was reading up over on the NASA site of the mission objectives. Check it out. They want to determine the mineralogical composition of the Martian surface and near-surface geological materials, attempt to detect chemical building blocks of life. We're always looking for that whenever we go to Mars. Interpret the processes that have formed modified rocks and soils, access long-time scale, i.e. 4 billion-year Martian atmospheric evolution processes, determine present state distribution and cycling of water and carbon dioxide, and characterize the broad spectrum of surface radiation, including galactic radiation, cosmic radiation, solar proton events, and secondary neutrons. Now, I'm going to come back to what's interesting about that list in just a minute, but I want you to think in terms of why those particular things? How do those things go together? Do you have an answer to that, Stephen, off the top of your head?
Well, I mean, I think that one thing that's I don't know if this answers your question at all, Phil, but they packed a lot of stuff onto this guy. I mean, there's a lot of scientific equipment, and so there's going to be an opportunity to do a lot of different things. And that's is that what you're getting at? I mean that.
Yeah, well, yeah, but there's I have a broader point I want to make about those particular things, but you make a really good point, which is that when they call this the Mars Science Laboratory, this really is a mobile lab that they've landed on the planet Mars. And it, you know, talk about we've come a long way. You think about Viking back in 1977, which was astounding technology in its day. The first time we put a lander on Mars, not a rover, because that didn't come around for years after that. But what was the extent of Viking's mobility on Mars? You know, it had a camera that I guess it could move around a little bit, and it had that arm, right? It could reach that arm out, scoop up some soil, bring it back in, and then there were these automated tests, chemical tests. You know, it was just basically shooting chemicals into the soil to see what kinds of things would happen. This is truly a laboratory. I mean, it's mobile. It's this, you know, I mean, it's really a robot. It's this mobile, intelligent device that is able to do all of this incredible stuff. So yeah, you look at it and you go, now this is huge. This is big, but maybe not so fast, because we were talking, I guess you didn't see this story over on the Borowitz Report in the New Yorker. Mars rover should not get so much attention, say Higgs boson scientists. And I'm going to read just a couple paragraphs of this.
Go ahead. I love that.
Great. The landing of the Mars science rover Curiosity does not qualify as a significant scientific achievement and should not be getting so much of the public's attention, says the team of scientists who discovered the Higgs boson last month. Quote, people see these beautiful pictures from outer space and they're inclined to think that something amazing has been achieved, a spokesperson for the Higgs boson team said. Let the Mars rover do something of genuine value, like, say, discover how the universe was created. Then I'll be impressed. As for the NASA scientists behind the Mars rover, the Higgs boson spokesman said, I don't think we should be too quick to use the word, quote, scientist here. Honestly, anyone can grow a mohawk, put on a headset, and look cool and all, but that hardly makes you a scientist. Let's see some of these dudes discover a particle or something along those lines. I mean, come on.
You know what this sounds like? This absolutely sounds like conversations that Sheldon has with Leonard on Big Bang Theory.
It does.
You know, I mean, Sheldon's always running down Leonard because he's a mere experimental, you know, physicist as opposed to what he is, and so a theoretical physicist, which is
exactly.
He holds himself out to be so much better because of that. But
I love it when Sheldon visits the DMV and he gets to the front of the line and the lady's sitting there and she looks at him and she goes, application, and he goes, well, I'm really more of a theorist.
Oh, God.
That is a nerd joke right there. Okay, that's
the funny thing is the audience caught it. They laughed.
Oh yeah, everybody liked it. Yeah. Anyway, you got to hear the response here. So from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, a response to the Higgs boson team's comments was swift and irate, as a NASA spokesman called the remarks an unacceptable diss. And then he is gone to be quoted, you know the difference between the Mars rover and the Higgs boson, said a NASA spokesman, his face red with anger. You can actually see the Mars rover. So obviously the Borowitz report is just a humor piece and none of this really happened, but it's good reading.
Yeah. It's a shame that didn't happen because, I mean,
know,
that's
it
hilarious. It should have happened.
It would be funny, but I'm going to, just for a moment, and I'm sure in real life that if the scientists on the Higgs boson team have had any comments at all, it's been very complimentary to their colleagues over at NASA. But just for a moment, I'm going to take the side of these fictional jealous Higgs boson scientists who are saying that this is not that big a deal. Because here's the thing: I remembered something this week as I'm looking at all the coverage and all the hoopla about this, because everything we've said up to this point is absolutely true about we weren't doing so well, and now we got our groove back. We've put this monster truck on this big vehicle. It's really cool. But And there's no question that not just compared to, say, Viking, but compared to anything else we've put on Mars that we've even called a rover, this thing is by far and away the most advanced, most sophisticated, and biggest and heaviest thing we've ever, you know, sent to the surface of another planet to do this kind of work. So it's this huge accomplishment. But as I'm watching everyone react to this, it reminded me so much of, I remember in 1981, would it have been, when the first shuttle launch occurred?
Mm-hmm.
And I was in college. My roommate, you know, was up all night watching it, and I was kind of watching it. I mean, I'm way into space, but I could not get excited about it because it always felt to me like, okay, wait, here's my life so far. Okay, when I was born, we were doing low Earth orbit, and then, you know, we're just doing satellites and starting low Earth orbit, and then we start sending people up into bigger and bigger craft. We start doing spacewalks, then we sent a ship around the moon, then we landed on the moon and walked on the moon, then we did increasingly sophisticated things on the moon, and now here it is.
Drove a car on the moon.
Yeah, I had a couple of cars driving around the moon. Here it is at this point, about 8 years later, and we're back to low Earth orbit. And to me, it felt fundamentally disappointing that the space shuttle didn't seem to be, you know, its whole idea was to orbit the Earth. It wasn't going to take us anywhere. And as sophisticated a piece of technology as it was, to me, it never felt like it was quite a step it didn't feel like it was where we needed to be next, you know. And I look at this and I go, God, we've already sent rovers to Mars. You know, I mean, this is huge.
Can I give a counter argument?
Of course, yes.
Okay, all the other rovers that we sent, Phil, were pretty much like about the size of a remote control toy, right? I mean, think about what was it, Mars Pathfinder, and you know, even Opportunity, and I think it was Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Those are fairly small rovers. This thing is big enough that it can have a capacitor compartment. We put something big enough on Mars that if, I don't know, if you had some sort of yoga expert who could have held a single position for a few months, we could actually have had a person on Mars with this trip.
Right, right.
This is a step in the right direction from that point of view. If you think about manned space exploration, we now have put something big enough on Mars that, you know, of course we have no intention of bringing it back, and that's going to be a huge thing, is bringing it back. But with our first people on Mars, maybe we send a couple old guys or something that have no intention to come home. I don't know what we'll do, but the future is kind of seems a little bit closer now we put something that big on Mars.
We're a little bit closer. The thing is, what we want to do is what Robert Zubrin says, right? Which is, we send people there to stay, right? We don't even think about them coming back. They're going to build infrastructure and start building cities and start creating the civilization there. And I think that if I sound like I'm being a buzzkill at all about this, and I don't mean to be, it's just this, that as impressive an accomplishment as this is, I weigh it against a scale that says, and I believe it was Bob Zubrin again who said this when I interviewed him, not on this show, but for The Speculist before that, that if we had rolled things out the way we should have, you know, the first, like, graduating class at the first high school on Mars would be graduating its, you know, those kids who were born on Mars would be graduating from high school right now. So it's kind of comparing the reality to what we giddily hoped for back in the 60s and 70s, where we were going to be in space. And the fact that we are now closer to sending a person to Mars is great, but the fact that we haven't already, like, got people living there is totally bogus. I guess that's the the counter.
You know, there's sometimes a pause in exploration between the first person to plant a flag and then going to stay. Think about the South Pole. How long was it between the time that there was that race to the South Pole, and we had one team that made it and one team tragically that did not?
That's right.
And then now we have people living on at the South Pole at South Polar Station all the time. It's just it was a good period of time. I mean, it was a period of about 50 years or so, I believe, at least, right? Probably more like 100. Between the, you know, that period of time and that period, you know, I think you sometimes when you realize that something is possible, you race out and do it. But then to have a sustained, presence in a hard place like the South Pole or the Moon or someplace like that, it takes a whole different level of commitment than just reaching that place. And so, maybe that, what we've experienced pretty much throughout our lives, Phil, is just that pause while we're getting ourselves, our act together enough to go those places to stay. And to make money there, and I think that's going to be the key, is that we go because it's profitable to be there, not just because we're planting flags.
That's got to be a big part of it. There's got to be every incentive to go, not just curiosity. Curiosity is a great motivation, but that alone won't get us to the stars. It's going to take incentives of a more material nature, I think, to get us there. I think that's a great point. And I also think it's possibly a mistake to view it as a lag, because truly we have made incredible progress. And going back to your point earlier, that we don't know what we don't know. We know a lot more about Mars today than we did back in the early 70s, when we should have been landing our first colony on Mars, according to the fantasy timeline that I lined out before. But I go back to that list. I go back to that list of mission objectives for the Mars Science Lab: get the mineralogical composition, look for chemical building blocks of life, look at what's going on with the atmosphere, look at the distribution and cycling of water and carbon dioxide, look at what kind of radiation is hitting the planet. This is recon, okay? I look at this and I go, okay, well, this is the checklist. These are the things you want to find out before you actually send a person there. I think maybe before they were doing more or less pure research. And, of course, this is all good scientific research, don't get me wrong. But these all feel like, to me, this really feels like a list. When you look at it, most of the items on there have to do with how well a human being will survive, or what kind of preparation you need to make before you think about sending a human being there. And when you start talking about water cycling and carbon dioxide cycling, you're thinking about long term. So maybe I'm reading into that list, but I look at that list and I go, see, they're thinking about sending people to Mars, and that's what that list is telling me. I hope I'm right about that, and I hope we get there one day. Probably won't be NASA that gets us there. It'll probably be some progeny of SpaceX or a company that or a group or an organization we've never even heard of at this point. But all this information that's being gathered is going to be critical to getting us there, that's for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is a story I read this week, Phil. It was a remarkable 3D printer, and I think you saw it also. You mentioned it before the show, that takes sand and makes basically concrete out of it in any shape or form that you want. I also noticed it was solar powered. That you can build buildings out of this stuff. We need maybe not solar powered, maybe nuclear powered, but whatever. We need a bunch of those on Mars building that city, getting a place ready for us to go to when we send people.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at if you follow the link and look at that story, it's really quite amazing. If you have some sand and a good supply of this bonding agent that's used with it, you can spray out any shape you want to. And I like that in the picture in the linked story, they show this really funky kind of Swiss cheese futuristic surrealistic kind of architectural design that someone has sprayed out. But the technology, the stone spray robot, it was developed originally just for architectural modeling, but it's occurred to them that, hey, you could make real buildings out of this. You could use this exact same process. And to your point, if you look at the pictures we've seen of the surface of Mars over the last 35 years, there does appear to be a certain amount of sand there.
Sand we have.
We've not found life, but I'm pretty sure we found sand. So we could start doing remote construction on Mars, start building the habitats, building some of the infrastructure, using robots like Curiosity, or like a generation or two more advanced than Curiosity, with some of these kinds of capabilities added, to really start preparing the way for people to come to Mars. And that's probably the right way to do it. There's probably an awful lot of groundwork that needs to be laid by machines before we even think about sending a person to Mars.
Right. And, you know, I think we need more than a couple of huts. I think we really need the equivalent of a small town. And so you need a bunch of Curiosities that are have the stone spray system or something similar mounted to it, and they can go to work. I mean, building this city for us, and I think that's going to be a big part of how we go to places like that, is that we have to be able to make things when we're there. We can't depend on the next shipment from Earth. If you need something, then, and not a year and a half from then. And so I think 3D printing is going to be a huge part of going places remote like Mars, or even asteroid belt, or any place where you need something quickly.
More advanced that 3D printing technology becomes, the more sophisticated the infrastructure that you can build prior to actually sending any human beings there.
We need things that we need 3D printers that can print electronics within a plastic case, and I don't believe that we're quite there yet. But I thought it was interesting. I did see a group testing a 3D printer on the Vomit Comet. You know, that's the airplane where they get a few moments of zero G.
Right.
And they had it printing out stuff in zero G just to see if that would work. Quite frankly, that's not good enough. You need a 3D printer on the space station, and I think that needs to happen right away.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. They need to start incorporating that technology into what they're doing in space. I couldn't agree more. Well, and there's one argument that says I see the question from Seven Inc. in the chat room, robots, the first true conqueror, will they call it their own? Will they revolt against us? Well, that's a risk you run when you send the robots out first. But what if by the time they send us, we're robots too? We talk often about this future wherein we merge with the machine intelligence, or we move our intelligence to another substrate, or there's lots of different ways of putting it. But did you see this story that I linked called Human Immortality Could Be Possible by 2045, say Russian scientists?
Tell me more.
This is pretty interesting. This guy, Dmitry Itzkov, he's got an initiative. He calls it the 2045 Initiative. And his plan is to have all the capabilities needed by that day, or by that year, for it to be possible for a human being to have their brain and or consciousness transferred to a robot and not die. So he's completely serious about this. He's hitting up billionaires, telling them that they'll be the first people to become immortal if they can help make this technology a reality. And it's interesting, the project is called Avatar, because we're talking about robots being controlled by the human mind. In the time frame that we're in roughly now, Avatar A, coming up soon, between 2015 and 2020, they're going to have a robotic copy of the human body remotely controlled via brainwaves. And this part of it, I don't think anyone disagrees, is at least theoretically possible. I mean, the Department of Defense is working on something similar to this, that ultimately we'll have soldiers out in the field that are just robots being controlled by people safely elsewhere. I mean, we do things like that with non-human-shaped robots as it is, and ultimately there will be more or less humanoid robots. The next stage, they have an avatar in which a human brain is transplanted, like right at the end of somebody's life. So you're dying, your body's not going to hold out anymore, so they take your brain and they put it directly into that robot, and now you're in the robot, you're living in the robot. Well, this is a great setup for, temporarily, unless, of course, what you're dying of is something that's wrong with your brain, right? That's not going to work. Or if you've got dementia or, you know, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or one of those, it's not going to help you much to be demented inside a robot body. But assuming an otherwise sound and healthy brain in a body that has broken down, this is a big leaping off point. This is a big wow. You know, suddenly you can survive the death of quote unquote the human body. Not counting the brain. Next comes the phase Avatar C between 2030 and 2035, where an avatar with an artificial brain in which human personality is transferred at the end of one's life. And I want to understand more about that, because I know you and I are on the exact same page of, unless your consciousness, unless your subjective experience has somehow moved over there, all you've got at that point then is a copy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, move my brain into a robot, you know, that is in some sense still me. If you copy me over, that's a copy of me. That's not me anymore, the way I see it.
And it's what Ray Kurzweil calls the continuity of consciousness. You've got to have, every day that goes by, you might be becoming more robotic. That's fine, because we're replacing our biological parts all the time anyway, right?
Right.
If you gradually become more robotic over a period of time, I've made the trip. But if you just copy me and stick me, you know, destroy my brain as part of a destructive copy process to then take that copy and put it over in a robot body, I don't see how I've made the trip. You have a very Steven-like robot, but I think poor Steven, rest in peace, you know. You and I agree on that point.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. And I can't help but think that if he's got a stage where they're actually putting the brain in, that Hitchcock must feel the same way. So he's got some plan for making the consciousness work its way over until ultimately you've got human consciousness in the silicon substrate, and the robot doesn't even have to be a physical robot. It can just be a hologram walking around. Basically, you're living in a computer, and you can manifest whatever visible physical version of yourself that you want to. Basically, it's like the real world becomes kind of like Second Life, right? And you can you can look any way you want and pretty much do anything you want. Well, it's hugely ambitious project.
Can I give you my opinion?
Sure.
About that? Something about it just doesn't pass the sniff test. You just can't plan. A project that goes that far out. There's just too many variables that intervene in the meantime. Much better is something like what Aubrey de Grey is doing, is outlining what the problem is with our biological aging, break it down. He's got, seven basic evil things that are happening to us that make us old, and let's break each one of them down into their components and begin the basic science to seek to solve these problems. And when will we be able to do it? He has an idea of when we'll be able to do it, but he's not giving any dates. I feel a little bit better about what Aubrey de Grey is doing, as wild as it sounds to people that are hearing it for the first time, and outlandish as that may seem to the average person. I think Aubrey's on the right page, whereas this other gentleman, I don't know. Just something about that just doesn't. Seems to me like he might just be seeking some funding from well-to-do people that don't want to die.
Assuming goodwill and good faith on the part of Dmitry Hitchcock, I will say that I love the sweep of it. I love the boldness of it. To me, this is like saying, I've got a plan to build a starship by the year 2045. Only this is much grander even than that, right? This guy is like, he's going to take us all the way to the new substrate and to immortality. So from a just sheer guts and chutzpah perspective, I give him full props. As far as whether this could really happen in that kind of time frame, wow, that's hard to get your head around. It's hard for me to believe that by 2045. A robot will exist, or by 2025, when they were talking about putting the first human brains in there. It's hard for me to believe that by 2025 a robot will exist that I would want to live in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
things can come along really fast, and so I might not be giving it credit. I might not be giving accelerating change the credit it deserves. But from where I sit right now, it's just hard to picture that it could possibly happen in that kind of time frame. There's a poll that accompanies the story about this, Stephen. So here's the question, because we talked about adopting that technology from last week. Let's say Aubrey's thing doesn't pan out, right?
Yeah.
Would you opt for cybernetic immortality if it existed within your lifetime? Let's say this is your choice, okay? It's this or cryonics, right? Because the other stuff hasn't kicked in,
or
okay?
Or just dying.
Yeah. Or, well, yeah, you know, that's always an option. Would you opt for cybernetic immortality if it exists within your lifetime? The choices are yes, at any and all costs. Yes, but only if I could afford it comfortably. No, I don't want to live forever. I don't believe this technology will ever exist. This idea terrifies me. I'm not sure, or other. So where would you fall on that one?
Well, yes at all costs and other. The other is biological immortality. If something like Aubrey Gray's plan pans out, and you can just choose to every few years go back and get your normal human body rejuvenated.
Right.
I think perhaps we'll have multiple options. If for those who want to say go colonize Mars, we have to probably leave the biological behind. But those of us who feel rather attached to our human cells may just stick around Earth. Humanity will go in a lot of different directions, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a model of this whole thing unfolding, because ultimately what Hitchcock's talking about doing is not out of line with the kinds of things Kurzweil talks about, or even that Aubrey de Grey talks about ultimately happening. But I think there's this much more comfortable timeline of, well, first we make the human body live longer, and we become increasingly augmented, and we become increasingly immersed with the technology, and the technology becomes increasingly sophisticated, and it embeds itself in us in ways that were never possible before. And gradually, right, gradually this conversion over to something else occurs. The idea of just, I'm an old man, I'm dying, get the saw out, yank my brain out of my head and plop it into a robot, or some variation on that, does not appeal very much, I got to say. That if it was the only game in town, I'd take it. But there are other timelines and other ways of getting there, per your point,
I think
aesthetically,
what we're
if no other reason, I prefer.
Yeah, well, I think what we're talking about is, we start with H+, and we just keep going. And eventually we're robots. I think that's what we're talking about. And yeah, keep your saw to yourself. I have no interest in being a brain in a jar.
Yeah, even a really righteous looking robot jar. Although we'll see. Sally points out that technology is going to advance in ways that we can't predict. Difficult to predict. Sometimes even difficult to imagine. One might say. So we should keep that principle in mind when talking about these things. Okay. So I got one last topic, real quick, because I know we want to spend some time on our music this evening. But you saw the story about the World Wide Web comes of age yesterday. Marked the, actually, I guess day before yesterday now, marked 21 years since the first page on the Internet became publicly available via the World Wide Web. So that is a turning point in human history, as I see it. And I'm just responding to something I saw over on Singularity Network the other day. This guy, Matthew Bryce Deutsch, he put up a post, and he said, "I'm tired of following a calendar made by a," his words, not mine, "creationist D-bag." He didn't say D-bag. He said the whole phrase. "Hundreds of years ago. Today's date, according to my new singularitarian calendar, is 8-7-64, not 1964, just 64. And so the first commenter says, "Why 64? And Deutsch replies, "It's the year of our Lord and Savior, Ray Kurzweil." Okay, so not ready to go anywhere nearly that far, and I'm sure that Ray Kurzweil wouldn't probably want to.
I I admire Ray as much as the next guy, and I've loved it when we've had him on the show. No, not ready to do that.
I'm not ready to do that. It actually turns into a really interesting discussion over there. People start saying, hey, yeah, we'll rename all the months after scientists. Somebody says, yeah, we can rename the months just like they did in the French Revolution. And I'm like, folks, as soon as you start saying, hey, let's do things just like they did in the French Revolution, I think you might be going down a bad road, okay? I'm just going to throw that out there. You know, let's,
it didn't work out, guys.
Yeah, when we get all excited, you got to read about the terror, you got to read about the guillotine and all that stuff. But anyhow, I got to thinking, you know, there's some interesting links in that discussion, too, about the Holocene calendar, and there are lots of different ways of divvying up human history and thoughts as to whether we would have another calendar. But, you know, you might say that a whole new era begins with the singularity, but in some ways I think it is fair to say that this is year 21 of a completely different world, a world that that Tim Berners-Lee helped to sort of deliver into being, kind of brought into being.
There's another option. This could be year 4. This could be year 42.
Okay.
Not because I was born in 69. I'm not that egotistical. But also that year a couple of interesting things happened. We did land a man on the moon.
Yes.
But also the first two nodes of what became the internet were connected in 69.
Oh.
So I mean, a lot of people have, well, World Wide Web is the internet. No, the internet predates. The internet is now 42 years old.
Yes, so it could be any of those things. If the calendar ever starts over, based on the kinds of changes that we're seeing now, it could very well be something like that. It could be that suddenly 1969 is year one, or who knows? Maybe when Turing built his first computer. There are lots of possibilities for what it might be. But I hope that we keep the same month names anyway. To me, that gets really interesting because these guys are responding about how they want to clear out the Christian calendar and get rid of, and it's like, okay, well, whatever. But you understand that those month names aren't Christian anyway. They're like ancient Roman, right?
Roman,
a bunch of Roman emperors and
named
after pagan gods and so forth. So
The days of the week are pagan. It's what you call legacy software, and we're hanging on to it, and I've got no problem with that.
Yeah, I like reminders of where we came from embedded in where we are now. And every now and then we do a complete reset, and we say that we're starting counting over. I'm not sure if we're actually going to hit that point or not. People are awfully conservative about that kind of thing, so it's going to take a big change to make that happen. But even if that does happen, I think we'll keep an awful lot of the legacy stuff, and I'm all right with that. Okay, well, enough about that. What's our music this evening?
The music tonight is Lime, like lemon lime. Lime is the name of the song by the Autons. The Autons.
Oh, the Autons.
A-U-T-O-N-S.
Singing Lime. All right. Well, thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the program. Couple of big shows coming up. Next week we'll be talking with I don't have his name in front of me. We'll be talking with listen, 3 weeks from tonight we're going to be talking with our good friend Jim Elvidge, so you don't want to miss that program. He's coming back, and we're going to be talking about some later research that he's been doing over the last couple of years that tends to indicate that, yes, we are indeed living in a computer simulation. So you're going to hear that show, and you're going to hear our show next week. I'll put the announcement up for both of them. Big shows coming up. Hope to have you all with us then, and until then, live to see it.
For my eyes, see them all the time, 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 hear them in the street.
20,000 pounds for every dot that stops. I remember what you said, the dead are happier dead. See 'em all the time, see 'em all the time, see 'em all the time. See 'em all the time, see 'em all the time, see 'em all the time.